This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. The Mount Laurel Doctrine of 1975 is considered to be an historic civil rights case. According to Mount Laurel, municipalities in New Jersey cannot use zoning to exclude housing that would be affordable to low and moderate income residents. In fact, they have to offer a fair share of such housing. But the road to full implementation has been rocky, and it is now in limbo. The Christie administration is stalling on new regulations. The Supreme Court is trying to determine how to react. And in the meantime, housing advocates say tens of thousands of families wait for access to safer neighborhoods and better schools. Here to start us off is Andrew Seidman. He reports for the Philadelphia Inquirer from the Trenton Bureau. Welcome, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
So let's begin by getting a brief history. Back in the 1960s, Mount Laurel, New Jersey, was essentially a farming town, and it was trying to move forward, correct?
That's right. And it was undergoing development like some other towns. And in the late 60s and early 70s, it had this development plan. And in part of that development plan, it was stepping up its code enforcement of substandard housing. And so you had in the late 60s the displacement of some poor mostly black residents who couldn't afford to live there. And they presented an alternative. They wanted to build garden apartments in Mount Laurel, but the township said, no, if you can't afford to live here, you need to live somewhere else. Hmm. And that was the sort of basis of the litigation. They said they challenged Mount Laurel's the township's decision on that, and they filed the lawsuit, and that's where it started.
And so the Mount Laurel decision, the first one, came down in 1975. There, ever since, there has been pushback. From whom?
From municipalities, from the state. You know, there's a line of reasoning that says, you know, the towns are the best ones to determine their own housing obligations. They know what they can. They know their capacity. They know how many units they can afford. You know, on the other hand, housing advocates and builders say, you know, the only way to build, get affordable housing done is to establish clear rules at the state level that assign each municipality their fair share of the region's need for low and moderate income housing. And if you leave this to the towns, they're just going to, you know, maybe decide not to grow, because, you know, towns can decide whether they want to have affordable housing or not. And I think experience and precedent shows that some had decided that they didn't want to have affordable housing. And so, you know, to leave this just to the towns was seen as not the best way to do this in the eyes of the courts, as we have seen over time, and certainly housing advocates.
So it's been 40 years, and yes, the argument continues. About 65,000 new homes have been built in that time. It sounds perhaps like a lot, but is it?
Well, that's a good question. I think what you know, housing advocates will tell you is it's a lot better than zero, and it's a lot better than what would have happened if not for the Mount Laurel decision, and if not for the Supreme Court's decision to intervene in the 70s and 80s. And you know, I think you could, one way to look at it is to see what the difference between the proposed plans going forward. And I'm sure we'll get to this, but housing advocates such as Fair Share Housing Center in Cherry Hill think that there should be some 175,000 affordable units built over the next 10 years. Contrast that with the proposal submitted by the state. It wasn't adopted, but this was their proposal, something like 40,000 units.
Huge difference.
Pretty big difference, yes.
So Governor Christie, as we said earlier, has called Mount Laurel an abject failure.
Yes.
Why? Why is that?
Well, he thinks that Trenton should get out of the way. He thinks that the towns are best suited to knowing what their development needs are, what their capacity is. He thinks that this is an issue where there's too much government. And frankly, you know, the Council on Affordable Housing, which administers and the rules and is supposed to be the one overseeing this affordable housing programs in New Jersey, isn't particularly popular among Democrats either.
Why is that?
It just has. I think there's a sense in the State House in New Jersey that it's been ineffectual. And that a more streamlined way of developing affordable housing rules might be the better way to go. You know, there was a legislative effort during Governor Christie's first term to abolish COA, which the agency, and to streamline the effort some. Now the legislature couldn't get on the same page as Governor Christie, and since then there's been a legislative inertia. You know, the governor tried to unilaterally disband the agency, which the Supreme Court said he couldn't do. And so there's this interesting separation of powers play among the three branches of government, also at issue here, in addition to the you know, issues of class and race and sprawl and all these kinds of things that affect municipalities throughout the state.
We're going to get into those issues in just a moment, but let's get to the chess match right now.
Sure.
Governor Christie has not made his move, and so the next move to further Mount Laurel lies in the hands of the state Supreme Court justices?
Well, yes. So what happened most recently was, about a year ago, the Supreme Court, state Supreme Court, struck down rules proposed by COA, which is in the executive branch. So it's part of the Christie administration. And the court said, look, you have 5 months to develop rules that are consistent with Mount Laurel, that are consistent with the Fair Housing Act of 1985, which was the legislation that codified the Mount Laurel Doctrine. COA received an extension in March, and they were said, the Supreme Court said quite clearly, if you don't have new rules published by November in the New Jersey Register, we will consider lifting a protection afforded to municipalities that protects them from exclusionary zoning litigation.
Mm-hmm.
So the COA, you know, drafted some rules, and they at their October meeting, their most recent meeting, they deadlocked on a motion to delay the rules, and then B, to adopt the rules. And you know, Fair Share Housing filed suit saying that they had failed to meet the Supreme Court order's deadline to submit the rules and adopt the rules.
So here we are in February of 2015, right. And what do you think the Supreme Court might do?
So the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in this case last month, and they roundly, you know, the justices seemed very skeptical that the COA was going to act anytime soon. The first question that Justice LaVecchia had during oral arguments was for the deputy attorney general. And the question was, has COA scheduled any meetings? Has it met since October 20th, its last meeting? And has it scheduled any further meetings? And the answer was no. And there didn't seem to be any confidence in the agency to do its job. To be fair, the agency by statute is a board that is composed of competing interests of different people that represent different interests with regard to affordable housing. You have people that come from the advocate side. You have people that come from people more aligned with Governor Christie's view.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a board that the Christie administration argues that by statute is designed to come to disagreement like this. So this isn't necessarily out of the ordinary.
So what do you think the state Supreme Court might do to move Mount Laurel along?
I think that the state Supreme—
I'm asking you to prognosticate.
Yeah,
here,
sure. So. Well, the Supreme Court indicated that they think that this is uncharted territory. They think that if COA isn't going to comply with their order, which they haven't, then they may very well open the door to litigation against municipalities. I mean, that's what Fair Share Housing Center has asked for. They've asked for one, the Supreme Court to open the door to litigation against towns, and two, for the Supreme Court to coordinate with trial courts a methodology that's consistent with Mount Laurel, that's consistent with the law.
So the litigation would essentially say to a municipality, if you do not comply, you're going to be sued. And many municipalities probably don't have coffers deep enough to deal with that, correct?
Sure. The municipalities say, look, if COA failed, if the Christie administration and administrations before it failed to develop sound and legal affordable housing rules, why are we the ones that should bear the brunt of that? Why should we be the ones that are sued for that? So that's their argument, and indeed they do say that affordable housing litigation is costly, that they can't afford it, and that therefore the best way to move forward in New Jersey is for either a legislative solution or for COA to get its act together.
And lawmakers, do they want to touch this with a 10-foot pole? I mean, last time was in 1985, right, when they came up with the Fair Housing Act.
So that was the last major, I think, piece of legislation. That's the law that's on the books, and that's mm-hmm. the law where through which, you know, the Supreme Court continues to interpret the regulations. Is it consistent with the Fair Housing Act of 1985? Now, there have been modifications since then, closing of loopholes, for example, in 2008, and things like that. But yeah, there hasn't been a comprehensive overhaul, and there was an effort in Governor Christie's first term, but it didn't go anywhere. And you know, I spoke with Senate President Steve Sweeney recently about this, and he said, "Look, the governor didn't sign our bill, and he seemed to think that the courts were best positioned to sort this mess out."
So let's get to Governor Christie for just a moment. How much of this, his stance as far as Mount Laurel is concerned, is wrapped up in his potential bid for the presidency next year?
Well, to be fair, in 2009, when he was running for governor for the first time, he campaigned on gutting the Council on Affordable Housing. This is an issue that's very popular with, suburban voters. And you know, this was a campaign position of his from the outset. You know, the issue of affordable housing in New Jersey is not unique to New Jersey, but the Mount Laurel doctrine is in many ways. I mean, it was a historic decision that hasn't been other courts in other states haven't gone that far in saying that there's a constitutional obligation for municipalities to provide their fair share of the region's need for affordable housing. And so I think Governor Christie looks at this and says, you know, on the one hand, it's an issue that might not resonate entirely with voters in some key presidential primary states. It's not at the top of the agenda there, but I think it's an issue that's very important to conservatives in New Jersey for sure.
And so, what are we hearing from you talked about the suburban voter? I mean, the pushback there. What is the primary concern? Is it quotas?
I think quotas are part of it. I think some people, there's a mentality of maybe not in my backyard. There's a mentality of and then certainly from the municipality's perspective, it costs a lot of money. And I think more than anything else, though, it's not that these groups don't want affordable housing. They just want a streamlined process. They want a process that people can understand. It's been so convoluted over the past a few decades. There haven't been certainly since 1999. There haven't been a new round of rules that have been required by the state, and so there's a lot of uncertainty among developers, among municipalities, among housing advocates. So there's really municipalities that want to provide affordable housing might not know what their obligations are, and so that becomes problematic for them because they say, well, if we commit to X number of housing units, that might not meet constitutional muster. We might have to do more, or maybe we didn't comply with the rules. So they're worried about that, I think.
Andrew Seidman, thank you so much. Thank you for the input. Andrew Seidman is a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He works in the Trenton Bureau. After the break, we'll be joined by housing advocate Kevin Walsh and Jeffrey Serenian, an attorney representing over 40 municipalities in affordable housing cases. Where do you land in the affordable housing debate? Give us a call at 888-477-9499. Back in just a moment. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowane. And this hour, we're tackling the affordable housing debate in New Jersey. Governor Christie is quoted as calling the historic Mount Laurel decision an abject failure. He's questioning the amount of affordable housing needed, and we're waiting to see what the Supreme Court does next. Joining us in studio is Kevin Walsh, Associate Director of Fair Share Housing Center. Welcome, Kevin.
Thank you.
And Jeffrey Serenian is an attorney who represents over 40 municipalities in affordable housing matters. Hello, Jeffrey.
Good morning.
And as always, if you have questions or comments, lines are open at 888-477-9499. And email works, too, radiotimes@whyy.org, as does a tweet at whyy.org. Kevin Walsh, first to you, what exactly is the need for affordable housing in New Jersey?
The need is tremendous, and it's comprised of two principal buckets of need, one of which is folks who, as our population expands, need housing. And our projection is that between now and the next 10 or so years, that the need approaches 175,000 units, both looking back and going forward. And then there's nearly a million people who pay too much for their housing because they pay more than 30% in the state of New Jersey to afford a place to live, whether it be rent and insurance or a mortgage. And those are folks who exceed the national standard in what they pay. And because of that, they can't afford things like clothes and food, or they have to struggle because they're paying for housing. They have trouble affording life's other necessities. And for a lower income household that pays half or more of its income toward housing, they're going to have trouble making ends meet in other areas.
Is there a typical client? Is it a single person, a family? Describe them.
There are a lot of families who need housing that's affordable. Many of them are led by single mothers. We hear from a lot of folks who are victims of domestic violence. We hear an awful lot from two-parent households who are earning maybe $12 an hour, each of them, and still have trouble affording a home in the state. And then there's a lot of people with disabilities. Sometimes folks who develop disabilities, especially later in life, and have to find a place to live. They're some of the folks who have benefited the most from the Mount Laurel Doctrine.
And a move to the suburbs does what?
Especially for families, a move from the suburbs to the suburbs gives people opportunities, whether it be good schools, proximity to jobs, whether it just be living in a safe area where one doesn't hear gunfire sometimes. Those are the things that we hear that have life-changing impacts on families who have benefited from the promise of Mount Laurel, kids who aren't afraid to walk to school. Kids who suddenly go to a place where most of the kids go to college. Those are the sorts of things that break cycles of poverty. And as a state and a country, we should look to Mount Laurel for the tremendous success it's had in that area.
Jeffrey Seranian, 40 years since the Mount Laurel Doctrine was implemented, 65,000 new affordable homes built since then. What are the principal difficulties, in your opinion, in implementing Mount Laurel?
Well, the problem is that we need standards with which to comply. And this bottleneck with the deadlock in the Council on Affordable Housing is really a problem, because municipalities have spent an enormous amount of their resources trying to develop plans, and they can't do so in the absence of rules. So as much as the housing advocates are crying for standards, so are municipalities. For the last quarter of a century, since the Council on Affordable Housing has been created, the pattern has been COA creates the rules, gives municipalities an opportunity to comply with them, and then municipalities devise plans to comply with those rules. So that's really the problem right now. The other problem is that we need numbers that are realistic. To have numbers that are unrealistic doesn't generate more housing. It just generates controversy.
When you mean numbers, are you talking about quotas?
Quotas, yeah. You know, for example, Mr. Walsh just indicated that he's advocated for 175,000 units in the next 10 years. That's 17,500 affordable units a year. If you look at the building permit data statewide, you know, in the last 10 years from 2003 to 2013, when we have data, there's only been 23,000 units of residential housing done statewide. So if you're going to impose quotas that are so over the top, it's not going to generate more housing. It's going to generate more controversy. And what we need is a system that we can coexist, that everyone can buy into, that we can have realistic goals and standards with which to comply.
Kevin Walsh?
Yeah, I think that there's a the difficulty with what Jeff says is that there's lots of gimmicks that are built into the law. So you can go and you get 2-for-1 at the Can-Can sale. Well, they have those same sorts of gimmicks under the state law. And so a rental unit counts for 2 in New Jersey when a family can't live in the bonus that they get on top of it. So over the years, because of some of the wealthier suburban resistance, there are a lot of gimmicks that have been put in place. And so the number you start with at 175 gets whittled down, and there's other gimmicks to get it down. Some ways to get it down based on a town not having sewer may be legitimate temporarily. Other gimmicks are just that, and so there's a way in which one needs to aim high in order to, under the law, get it to a place that. You know, that 65,000 units, in order to get that, you needed to have the numbers aiming higher in order to account for the gimmicks.
So you're thinking 175,000, but you would be happy with what?
I'd be happy with 175,000, but I think that we, you know, there is a lower number that over the next decade would be produced. But there are obligations that were assigned to municipalities in the 80s, and some municipalities are still meeting them. So there's no assumption that the obligation would be fully met in the 10 years. It's just that as the construct that is in place in New Jersey for looking at these policies needs to begin with a big number to end up with probably at the end of the day a significantly smaller number.
Jeffrey, what does, if we have to use the word quota, what would work with most municipalities?
Well, I don't have any magic bullet for you. I can't tell you the exact number. But
or percentage.
One of the concepts that was devised in legislation that also deadlocked between the governor and the legislature was a model where the number was driven by how much residential and non-residential growth existed in each town. So that's an approach. You know, that has its issues as well. There's really no panacea here. There's no one solution that's gonna work. But I think that, you know, taking into account that there are instances where you can get rental bonuses and instances where it's not exactly 175,000. Clearly, unquestionably, the magnitude of the numbers that Fair Share Housing Center has advocated are over the top and aren't within the realm of reason, and they're just going to generate controversy.
What numbers should the municipalities have? What would they be willing to do? If it's not 175, what is it?
Well, again, I don't have a panacea right here, right now, but the bottom line is, you know, courts are going to have to devise numbers if COA doesn't do so, and then there's, as you know, Kevin, there's no answer to that until we see the numbers and we test them into what's reasonable for any given municipality.
We're going to approach the third rail here. I'd like to take this in a bit of a different direction. Is the Mount Laurel debate in 2015 one of race and class? It might be argued that it was back in 1975, but is that still the case today?
I don't think it was ever intended to be about race. The Supreme Court was very, very careful to not make it about race, to confine the decision to income.
The Supreme Court had recognized in the 70s that New Jersey was growing towards racial segregation. It had experienced that in the 60s with white flight that occurred. And what the court said was, as New Jersey grows more racially and economically segregated, we have to realize that's bad for the state. So it was Mount Laurel is a doctrine born in the recognition that racial segregation is a problem, but it provided an economic remedy to that with the hope that that the apartheid that we experience in many parts of New Jersey would be significantly better after Mount Laurel was put in place.
We've got a lot of calls and comments coming in, so let's get to the phones. Dan in Mount Airy, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, nice to be with you. 1975, I drew the first Mount Laurel map for the Department of Community Affairs. In those days, there was no computer graphics, so the low man on the totem pole got the colored pens.
Uh-huh.
And I also helped draft the Affordable Housing Act in 1984 when working in the legislature. The idea that we're still litigating over a law that old is really, to me, shocking and appalling. I don't think anybody who was involved at the time thought this was the forever approach. It was an approach of how to deal in a crisis where every municipality and county after county was being sued, and that was clearly not a good way of doing business. If you go back to the original Mount Laurel decision, Justice Willis writes movingly about a post-apocalyptic view of New Jersey cities, which, you know, was reasonably in 75, was reasonably in 1985.
Well,
but it didn't happen. It ultimately didn't happen.
You know what, Dan? It seems as if it was a simple concept, but it is. It's almost, Kevin and Walsh and Jeffrey Serenian, it feels unwieldy. How do you move it forward in 2015? Why has it taken 40 years for resolution?
The bipartisan bad faith on this has been extensive, but I think at the end of the day, I think one of the issues has really been that it's not about the housing in many ways. It's about affordable housing turns out to be a terrible rateable. And in every municipal city community that's fighting for rateables and lower taxes, this is just seen as a bad deal.
Dan, thank you very much. That's a great point. Jeffrey Serenian, what do you think?
It's not my experience. My experience is that the pushback you see from municipalities is largely a function of too much housing being produced to generate too little affordable housing. The builder's remedy, which is a technique that the Supreme Court authorized in Mount Laurel 2, allows developers to sue municipalities, and if they're successful after jumping through many hoops, they are permitted to do generally 20% of all the units are affordable. So the pushback in my experience is if you have too much of your quota that you're satisfying through that technique, it forces towns to overbuild. And that factor, more than any factor, is what creates the antipathy towards the Mount Laurel doctrine.
Kevin?
The great thing about Mount Laurel is it allows municipalities to meet their obligations without using any municipal money. The private sector will come in and build 80% market rate, 20% housing that's affordable every day of the week in nearly any New Jersey town, certainly any New Jersey suburban town. And so really government just has to get out of the way. Now, government doesn't want to get out of the way. And so what they can do is they can work with nonprofits sometimes, and they don't need to do the 80-20 where 4 out of 5 are market rate. But in order to do that, they have it's harder work. Mount Laurel simply requires a town to rezone. And the truth of the matter is we not just need more housing that's affordable in New Jersey. We need more housing overall. We need housing for people who aren't lower income but are just barely not lower income. We need, it used to be that a family starting out could buy a nice little house with a picket fence, and our policies in New Jersey, because of the wealthier suburban resistance, too often deny us those opportunities. And so we need more townhouses. We need more apartments. We need more little houses.
Kevin, how do you make it more palatable to communities that might not want to see high-density housing and might want to have been a more rural setting?
Yeah, so much of New Jersey is rural, and those are places that by design have significantly lower, if any, housing obligation at all. They may have to do a few units, and very often they work with Habitat for Humanity to do that. Very often they work with other nonprofits. That is certainly the sort of thing that the courts have protected, that poor planning is not covered by Mount Laurel. But there's lots of towns. Cherry Hill, for instance, claims that allowing redevelopment that includes affordable housing, in the past they've told courts that promotes sprawl. Well, Cherry Hill, to the extent it sprawled decades and decades ago, having nothing to do with housing that's affordable. And redevelopment is the sort of thing that should occur in ways that provide housing both for people in the upper income ranges and in the lower income ranges. And when that can happen in a mixed-use way, where people can work in the supermarket that's also coming in as part of the redevelopment, that is a win-win. It results in there being lower commuting times, but a lot of towns unwisely, unreasonably use their home rule powers to resist legitimate redevelopment that the market demands, including redevelopment that's close to transit, and that's bad for our state.
And Jeffrey Serenian, let me get a quick comment from you before I get back to the phones.
The formulas that are used to determine affordable housing quotas don't always operate reasonably. There's plenty of rural municipalities that have very substantial numbers and no practical way of dealing it. And the formulas are such that, if a municipality can demonstrate that it has not excluded low and moderate income households and is a quintessentially inclusionary community, the formulas often still give that municipality very large fair share numbers. The classic example is Toms River, that if you look at the demographic profile of Toms River, it has zoned to allow people of all different incomes, and it has a large percentage of low and moderate income households. But it was hit with a number of 2,400 in the first housing cycle. So there are many severe flaws with the regulatory system that need to be taken into account when you devise any new system.
All right, let's head to Medford, New Jersey, and Marlene, you're live on Radio Times. Hi, Marlene.
Hi. Our town was involved with COA for many years, resisting as with all their strength, and including using gimmicks like not having sufficient sewer availability, while meanwhile having enough sewer to build two new schools.
So, Marlene, why the resistance?
Why the resistance? Because it's an affluent community that didn't want those people, quote unquote, in their town. The other thing is, often affordable housing brings lots of children, which means increasing the school population, which means increasing taxes, because these, I think was mentioned before by one of your guests, are very poor ratables, affordable housing. But the point I would like to bring out also is that the builders who did not want to put the 20% affordable in their units when they were building had to contribute to the municipality so that the municipality could build these units. And the municipalities have collected hundreds of thousands, maybe millions, I don't know, of dollars for this. But they can't continue until COA sets up rules to tell them what they need.
It is unwieldy. I don't mean to cut you off, Marlene, but we're up on a break, and I thank you very much for the call to Radio Time. Some good points made. On that note, our guests are Jeffrey Serenian, an attorney representing 40 municipalities in New Jersey. Kevin Walsh is Associate Director of the Fair Share Housing Center. Our telephone number is 888-477-9499. We are back with more on affordable housing in just a moment on Radio Times. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. The debate this hour is over affordable housing in New Jersey. How much is needed? Is the Mount Laurel Doctrine a failure, as Governor Christie has charged? And what happens next? The ball apparently is in the hands of the state Supreme Court. Our telephone number is 888-477-9499. You can contact us via email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I'd like to start off this last segment with an email from Edward. He says, in many communities, the primary obstacle to affordable housing is the cost of the land. There's only one sure way to bring down this cost, and that is to restructure property taxation to a tax on land values alone. And he says about 25 Pennsylvania cities and several school districts have moved in this direction. Jeffrey Serenian, what do you think about that?
I don't know that that's the only solution. I know that there's a significant debate going on about taxes and, you know, the cost of educating kids. But in my experience, the solution doesn't really focus on that. The solution focuses on, you know, coming up with a system that creates realistic, achievable numbers and has not centered on the tax issue.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, then the municipalities that you represent, and I see that there are 40 of them in affordable housing cases, are open to numbers, to affordable housing requirements. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, yes. I mean, let me put it this way. I don't know that every single municipality would agree, but I think it's fair to say that we need numbers. We need to know what the standards are, and we need to have targets that we can try to achieve.
It's how to get there that's the issue. Kevin Walsh, yeah. You're nodding your head.
Yeah, I think that's right. And what we at Fair Share Housing Center have urged the court to do is to get around the barriers that have been erected by inaction by the Council on Affordable Housing and by the governor's opposition to Mount Laurel, and to allow this to return to the trial courts as a second-best alternative in the absence of a functioning state agency and in the absence of there being a consensus between the legislature and the executive branch. And we know how this works. Some towns will be sued. Many towns should be sued. They've done little or nothing. They've gotten in the way. They've been unreasonable. The best thing that could happen for New Jersey is for them to be sued. Other towns should have the ability to prepare their own plans. They don't need the incentive of litigation in order to comply. They should be given that chance. We can have a statewide system up and running within a few months after the Supreme Court rules, and we're optimistic, given that argument was about a month ago, that in the next month or so, hopefully, but certainly by the springtime, that the New Jersey Supreme Court will rule and will get a system up and running so Mr. Serenian's clients will know what the rules are, so that lower-income households will benefit from the pipeline getting started back up of development in New Jersey, and so that towns that are reasonable will be given a chance to comply. Towns that have shown that they're obstructive and unreasonable will be given a chance to get sued, as they should be. Hmm.
Jeffrey?
There's 314 towns that filed affordable housing plans with the New Jersey Council on Affordable Housing and asked the Council on Affordable Housing to approve those plans. All 314 of those towns have one common principle that pertains to them, and that is they all sought to voluntarily comply with the requirements of the law. And the legislature promised them, when it enacted the Fair Housing Act, that if they did that, that they would secure protection from exclusionary zoning lawsuits, and they would have the right to comply without the enormous burdens of litigation. And so any solution to this problem that might push this whole issue from the Council on Affordable Housing to the court needs to recognize what the legislature was trying to achieve, and the courts have an obligation to follow the legislative mandate, which is to try to advance their goals of fostering the production of affordable housing without litigation. Every single one of those municipalities should have the opportunity, if we're going to find ourselves in court instead of at COA, to first have the courts tell us what the rules are, and secondly, to have the opportunity to comply with those rules in front of the court. Just because the Council on Affordable Housing failed to garner a fourth vote to break the deadlock, those municipalities should not have to pay for COA's sins.
Okay, let's get back to the phones. Jim, in Haddon Township, it looks like, New Jersey, is on the line. Hello, Jim.
How are you?
Well.
Good. So we live in a little town, Westmont, in South Jersey, and there are several hundred proposed low-income housing units, including rental units, that are going into the neighborhood. We have one little school that is going to be overwhelmed with people who aren't paying taxes, who aren't contributing to the tax base. The infrastructure is going to be overwhelmed. There's not enough, you know, traffic flow. There's only one sort of main street. And it's not something that's sustainable. The reason that we moved into this neighborhood with full expectation of paying taxes is that we were going to go to a small school that our daughter could, you know, that we moved out of Philadelphia so that our daughter could go to a school that was small. Whereas now the school is going to be overwhelmed with people who aren't contributing to the tax base.
Thank you for the call, Jim, to Radio Times. That's a common sentiment, Kevin. I mean, is there, and again, we heard this earlier in the show, you know, he says people aren't going to be contributing. People, if they're working, will be contributing, but the tax, you have to build new schools. It could result in an increase in taxes. Is that an understandable argument?
It's only understandable if you accept the fear that probably motivates most people who and the distortion of facts. The reality is that in that small town, Haddon Township, there's a redevelopment, two redevelopment projects, one of which is going to have 200 homes, the other of which is going to have 80. Between the two of them, there will probably be 40 or 50 homes that, in the best case scenario, in our view of the law, would be affordable. The rest will be luxury market rate rentals or townhouses. And, you know, there's often fear that the sky will fall. It doesn't. And one can have new development, we learn, that's really good for small downtowns that have little shops where they want people to shop. And so a lot of this is driven by fear of the unknown. A lot of it is driven by fear of things changing. And the reality is that in community after community where there's development that occurs, redevelopment, folks find that it's generally a very positive experience. It's good. Many of those schools have empty seats in them, and they suddenly learn that their brother and sister or cousins who are struggling financially are eligible for the housing that's built down the street from them. And their fears very, very, very rarely after the fact would they say they've been realized.
Jeffrey Sereni, in your perspective?
Look, I think that municipalities understand generally that there needs to be some change to address their responsibilities. The issue is not whether there needs to be change. The issue is the magnitude of the change and what's reasonable. Again, I keep on circling back to give us achievable goals. You'll get far more affordable housing if you give us achievable goals than if you just push the numbers into the stratosphere and force municipalities to dig in.
And here's a question. Are the courts the arbiter of the achievable goals? Is this where this should land, the courts?
Well, that's not where it should land. Where it should land is the legislature enacted the Fair Housing Act and charged COA with the responsibility of establishing the rules. So COA has an obligation under the legislature to establish rules. The legislature gave them primary jurisdiction. One of my beefs is COA should be held accountable for its failure to break the deadlock.
Kevin, you agree?
We've tried for 15 years to get this agency to do the right thing, and it's not capable of doing it. And the governor sent his lawyers into the Supreme Court, and they effectively said, we're done. We don't have any meetings scheduled. We have no plans to comply with your order. And at the end of the day, you know, it's easy to say, let's keep trying. It's easy for towns to say, let us voluntarily do it in the courts. The reality is that this is politically difficult for some people to get their heads around, but these are nevertheless rights. And when you have rights that for 15 years have been ignored or have been under-enforced, the courts are there for this purpose.
So you say it should go to the courts.
Well, you know, maybe at year 10 I might have said something slightly different, but at year 15, with the prospect of us getting to year 20 with no real progress, at that point we have to, if the rights that the Supreme Court recognized are going to be meaningful, and truly it's an issue as well of institutional integrity for the courts, if their orders are going to be complied with in a way that is meaningful, then there needs to be an alternative remedy. And telling the agency to go back and do it is simply going to lead to more delay, because at the end of the day, the governor controls the staff, and he has said that he's done, he's not doing anything. And the legislature can't get a bill through on this issue that the governor, who has somewhat extreme views on this issue, in my view, will sign. And so at the end of the day, we have a system that has worked in the past to get housing built and to keep towns from acting unreasonably. And that's the system we need to use.
Jeffrey?
At this point.
The Council on Affordable Housing has a job to do. And just because it's failed to do its job doesn't mean that the Supreme Court should give them a second chance. What it should do is it should demand from them that they do their job or inform them that you will be held in contempt if you fail to do your job. The initial remedy that I've recommended is exactly what the appellate division ruled in a prior proceeding in response to a motion by Fair Share Housing Center. So the position I've taken before the court is, before you throw this to the court, which will generate an infinite number of new issues and tremendous litigation, and will have very significant delays as these issues get sorted out in court, you should tell the Council on Affordable Housing, you have a job to do, not only in response to our order, you have a job to do in response to the legislation that created you. Do your job, meet regularly, have subcommittee meetings, report to me, and if you fail to break this deadlock, then tell me why you shouldn't be held in contempt of court. If a member of the Council on Affordable Housing is playing games, as Mr. Walsh has been suggesting, they're going to be very concern about having to sign a certification that explains their conduct.
I want to get to one more thing before we wrap up the hour. Briefly, it's an analysis called Climbing Mount Laurel, written by Princeton sociologist Douglas Massey. Essentially, it says it looked at the folks who moved into Mount Laurel, into the affordable housing, compared them with some who are trying to get into affordable housing. Families who are able to get housing there did much better economically. Children earned somewhat better grades in the Mount Laurel schools. But, Kevin, moving into the suburbs is not a panacea for everyone, as Climbing Mount Laurel points out. In quotes, those mired in substance abuse, criminality, family violence, household instability need more support than a decent home in a peaceful neighborhood with good schools. What is your reaction to that?
Yeah, I think Mount Laurel is one part of an important housing policy in the state. And for families that are employed, that are nevertheless struggling, Mount Laurel provides the promise that if you work hard, if you strive in terms of employment, and if you want your kids to go to good schools, there aren't a huge number of opportunities in the state, but there are some. And we know from the Climbing Mount Laurel study by Doug Massey at Princeton University, we know that this has the ability to break cycles of poverty. We know that this has the ability to have a life-changing impact. And it's what makes it all the more morally outrageous, in my view, that 15 years in, we're still struggling with this when we know that the opportunities here, that and this is good for our economy to have well-trained folks that haven't struggled in failing schools. This is good for our state overall. We need to figure out a way forward because of just how important this is.
So the way forward, where does this end in your view, Kevin? And then Jeffrey, I want to bring you into the conversation as we close this up. We're starting to wrap up. How much longer before there's resolution here?
I'm optimistic that we'll hear from the Supreme Court soon and that will get the process going and that there will be 100 or more towns that will do the right thing and comply. History has shown that many, many municipalities who complain about this being expensive will fight even one unit going in. They'll fight five units going in. For them, there's a political gain to complaining about these things, and they'll complain, all the while nothing happens. And that's why it's important for the courts to police this so that towns that are complaining about this still don't, just escape.
And Jeffrey Serenium, where do you see this going?
We're going to have standards one way or another. The Supreme Court's either going to direct COA to do its job or suffer contempt proceedings, or they're going to turn it over to the courts, and trial judges are going to determine the standards. And in my experience, there's 314 towns right now before the Council on Affordable Housing that have committed themselves to comply voluntarily, and there's another at least 50 that have done the same in judicial proceedings. So once we know the rules, we'll be in a position to comply with them. What's important is that we have realistic rules. We have realistic rules that's going to do the most to generate more affordable housing. And if we diminish the amount of builders' remedy lawsuits so that municipalities can use their finite public resources on developing and implementing affordable housing plans instead of fending off deep-pocketed developers, that's what's going to be best for everybody.
On that note, we have to wrap it up. Jeffrey Serenian is an attorney who represents over 40 municipalities in affordable housing issues. Thank you for joining us, Jeffrey.
Thank you.
And Kevin Walsh, thank you so much for joining us, Associate Director of Fair Share Housing Center. Good
Thanks.
To have you here. Remember, you can visit our Facebook page and check out our podcasts by heading to our homepage, whyy.org/Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowain. Thanks for joining us. Hour 2 is just ahead.